Oh, do you have a cassette in there? Bravo. Okay. How did you get interested in your approach to medicine and healthcare?
When I was a medical student, I wanted to find out what kind of doctor I wanted to be. I didn't know doctors. I didn't grow up with doctors. And I had this fantasy of how doctors were supposed to be, humanistic. They were there to serve humanity. That was the impression that I got. When I got to medical school, I found a dramatically different picture of the physician as a very competitive, a very prestige, power, and money-oriented kind of person. And in studying the healing arts and what the role of a physician was, I found two great concerns. One, I wanted to be a happy physician. I wanted to be a happily married physician. The divorce rate, the suicide rate, the general happiness rate among physicians is pretty low. And I wanted to be a happy family man physician. In reviewing the literature about the practice of medicine, I found four major areas of concern. And in my senior year, I drew up a project that I've been working on the last 13 years to address those four major concerns. The first major concern is the cost of health care. It's skyrocketing. There are some recent books on that. Paul Starr's A Social Transformation in Medicine, Dr. Wohl's Medical Industrial Complex, talk about the future of medicine being for-profit hospitals, conglomerates, Exxon approach to medicine, which is horrible, and it will make the doctor, they'll lose their sovereignty. And this was pretty obvious to me 13 years ago. And so what I wanted to do was not charge anything. So that was in the design. Another one of the concerns that goes right along with that is how the third-party insurance plan has driven the cost of health care and the way people practice, what they order, et cetera, way up. So from our beginning, we've never carried or allowed any insurance, Medicaid, Medicare, the Blue Cross, Blue Shields, any of those things. We've never accepted any payments. The third thing that was of great concern to me was the dehumanization of care. The very little time spent with patients, how if you were in an HMO in a big group, they constantly changed which physician you saw, the very little continuity of care, very little concern with the quality of life of the person. It was primarily a cookbook kind of relationship. You came in with a set of symptoms, and that was the only time you came to the doctor when you were sick with a set of symptoms. He did a physical exam, took some tests, and then gave some pharmaceutical or surgical intervention. I didn't feel that that was the way I wanted to be. I wanted to be a family doctor. I wanted to live with our patients. I wanted them to come to our homes. I wanted to go to their home. And so in my senior year, I developed a 2 to 4 hour interview with patients as the initial interview, and I've held on to that ever since.
So it sounds like everything, all the ideas that you developed in medical school, you've pretty much been able to put into practice in the Gesundheit Institute.
Yes, it's only more reinforcing every year. Can I list the final issue was the malpractice issue. One of the great tragedies in the practice of medicine is that from the get-go, from the very first interaction with a patient, you're saying, I don't trust you. You enter that interaction covering yourself for millions of dollars of malpractice, which really hurts the physician and the patient both in trying to create a friendly relationship with each other. And so from our beginning, we've never carried any malpractice insurance.
I'd like to ask you about that malpractice and your philosophy on that in a few minutes.
Sure.
Could you describe the facilities and the staff and like the combined expertise and medical credentials of the people that run the Gesundheit Institute?
All right. Right now, we're in a transition period. For our first 12 years of operation, we lived in a group home. There were 15 to 20 of us, at least two, most of the time three physicians. These are licensed MDs.
Wait, would they be considered like GPs, general practitioners?
Two of us were family doctors and one was a psychiatrist. And we, in essence, opened our home to anybody in need. We lived in a suburban country farming setting, so we had an active farm, we had active arts and crafts, active performing arts, and this sort of thing, active family life, and at the same time, whoever wanted to come to our home and have a health interaction, whether they needed to spend the night or a week or just as an outpatient visit. And what happened was that we've had 15,000 people in our home since the beginning, and the non-professional staff, because we never had a facility, we had as many as 50 guests at a time and no beds to offer them. So we've had nothing resembling a private life, which made the burnout factor quite large for the non-professional staff. And so they asked us to cut back on our care, and we said we haven't been developing this all these years to cut back. So we caught that as a hint that what we had to do was to go on to our next step, which was to really cut way back on our practice right this minute. So for the last year, we've been practicing practically none and devoting our times to raising the funds to build a free facility.
It sounds like the facility that you were in before you can't enter this transition period might in some spots look like a house and in other spots look like a doctor's office? Or am I not visualizing it correctly?
With our artistic bent, we had a part of our movie set was a Welby arrangement. We had a room that was white and had stuff in it that looked medical. Most of it looked like a home. It was a home. The real crux of the situation was that our ideal patient was somebody who wanted to form a deep, intimate friendship with us for the rest of their lives, for the rest of our lives, that we would grow together, that we would each know about each other's life, that they would come with their families, ideally stay as much as a week time so we could get to know them, so they could get to know us, so they could feel that the environment was a sanctuary type of thing. In case a serious illness or problem ever arose, they would already have a place that, by the sheer nature of the relationship they had, they would start to feel better and more relaxed and better able to face the crisis that they were having.
Did you work with other hospitals or other doctors? Were there cases that you felt you weren't not equipped to take on that you recommended elsewhere?
Sure. We see ourselves as complements, not as alternatives. We are just part of anyone's health team. No health professional can cover all of the problems that come to them. We saw ourselves as being that part of a person's health team that was intimate with them, the GP, the person that wanted to know everything, hold hands, know when people graduated, when the piano recital was, that sort of thing. And that if we needed any kind of high-tech care or complementary kinds of care, non-traditional medicine kind of care, if we didn't practice it ourselves, we're more than happy to and encourage people to try many different approaches if they can afford both the time and the financial commitment to try these other approaches. When we open in West Virginia, it's going to be a little bit different because we're going to have a lot of the technology there. When we open, we want a full surgical suite. We're going to have surgeons and OBGYN kinds of things so that there'll be, I don't know what level of surgery, but we will have whatever level that the community of people that we serve helps us finance. Since we charge nothing, all of our materials and wealth comes from people's donations.
Do many of your patients or had your patients in the past, did they test your credentials since it is such an untraditional, untraditional looking type of medical care place, and it's so different. Did you have patients trying to psych you out to see what your skills really were, what the bottom line of treatment would be, that type of thing?
Oh, sure. We encouraged our ignorance, is a way we looked at it. We encourage people to take care of themselves, to be responsible for their own health, because we tried to help them understand that all medical intervention has dangers attached to it, whatever the level of expertise. There are certainly just as many people called us to get their second opinion after seeing their straight or more traditional style physician. So many people checked with a straight and traditional style physician after they saw us.
What were the type of cases you didn't feel equipped that'll help our listeners define what your practice was like?
Again, what we hope to do in West Virginia is different than what we've had. What we've had, we have been living on a shoestring for all these years. We've had frontier-style medicine. We've learned to practice, I think, high-quality medicine with almost no frills. We only ordered lab tests when it was necessary for the improvement of the patient. We prescribed very few pharmaceuticals. And if we suspected an ulcer, we didn't have to have it confirmed by an X-ray. So a lot of things that normally people test for, we didn't. Intuition became a major part of our practice. It was something that that fits in that realm of the art of medicine, and the modern medical style has eliminated a lot of that intuitive part of medicine, and we've tried to reestablish that part of medicine. But we would see, again, as family doctors, we saw the entire gamut from birth to death. We've been involved in home births and home deaths. We, even if a patient goes to a medical facility for high-tech cancer therapy, they would also come to us for cancer consultations. I mean, again, we, as complements, whatever serious illness came to us, we had something to offer regardless of what else they were doing for their situation.
What type of support have you been getting from the medical establishment, both in your previous practice and in your attempts to enlarge your the institute?
We've not had any interaction with any of the societies, neither positive or negative. They've never approached us. We've been very active in some of the public health departments because we do home care and do a lot of that. So those people have been very thankful for our existence. We've get many of our referrals from other physicians. We are the physician for a large number of physicians and that sort of thing. To our face, we've had very little negative response. I think that people that may hear of us in a talking show kind of format might form an opinion from not seeing us. But the physicians that have come and spent some time with us all see that we're caring and that we just have our particular style.
I would have assumed that it would be something that the medical establishment would not only question but claim could be really dangerous and could provide health care which isn't good for patients because it's not using the latest technology, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I might be wrong in that assumption, but what's your sense of what the establishment thinks?
Well, I'd like to say we use the latest technology when we think it's necessary. We think it's overused. Since the profit from medicine is from disease and it's all based on using the equipment, then people are kept tabs of how often they use the equipment. Doctors are kept tabs of, and the more the for-profit hospital system takes over, that will occur. And we obviously are in great conflict with for-profit medicine. And I'd like to really make that distinction. We're not against any kind of practice of healthcare. We think they're all complements. We think there's a great amount of suffering and that there's a need for all kinds of health care. What we feel very badly against, and I think that we'll never get along, are the for-profit situations. The whole idea of profiting from people's suffering is terrible.
But do you think that the sense of human exchange and interchange that you try to employ in your own practice, do you think that's necessarily absent between a doctor and a patient just because there's payment involved?
No. Payment isn't the issue here, I think. It's greed that is the issue.
Well, what distinction would you make?
Well, there are some flagrant examples of that. If you took if you look across the nation at obstetricians' C-section rates, there have been physicians with a 70% C-section rate. It should be very low, the C-section rate. There are many women who have talked to me, and these things have been shown by people certainly far more traditional than us, that often from the first visit to a obstetrician, they kind of plant the seed that you'll be getting a C-section versus a vaginal delivery. I think there's a lot of conflict of interest. When the doctor owns a X-ray machine, that kind of doctor is obviously going to order a lot more X-rays and does order a lot more X-rays. That's what I'm talking about, where the patient's interest isn't the primary focus of the physician.
Let me reintroduce you for listeners just tuning in. I'm speaking with Dr. Patch Adams, and he's the founder and the acting director of the Gesundheit Institute, which is based in Arlington, Virginia, and the institute is now working to establish a new medical center in West Virginia. It's a nonprofit healthcare. Really, it's like a commune, isn't it?
Yes.
Is it? Where'd you get the name Gesundheit Institute, by the way?
The first reason is that it makes people laugh. And it's very important when you live with your patients, when your home is the facility, to create a humorous atmosphere. Otherwise, the suffering, the tragedies that go on would be a terrible home life. So it makes people laugh. Literally translated, it means healthness, which is one of our major thrusts for people to be healthy, the business of being healthy. It also summons up the idea of God bless you and to your health, which are important aspects of our feeling of healthcare, importance of faith in medicine, the importance of people saluting one another, caring for one another.
Well, you work this might be a bad analogy, tell me what you think of it, but it like a musician who has to do a day gig to support their primary thing in life. You work at St. Elizabeth's in Washington. What do you feel about making a salary as a medical professional at St. Elizabeth's?
Well, I certainly have to thank St. Elizabeth's. The first 6 years that I set up Gesundheit, I borrowed $3,000 a year to live on for my wife and I, and I felt I had to stay at home full time to develop this thing. As we got larger and more active, it seemed important for me to try to pay off some of the big debts, or seemingly big debts, and to try to bring in some income to try to help get our facility off the ground. So I was looking for a kind of medical job that wouldn't compromise my ethics. The job I have at St. Elizabeth's is a medical student job. It is doing histories and physicals, filling out paperwork forms in the emergency room. I never have to prescribe any medication. I haven't, in my 6 years there, ever prescribed anything. I don't decide, it is a mental hospital, and I don't decide who is admitted or is not admitted. In the room with those patients, I'm able to be the kind of physician there that I am at home. And so, as much as I would prefer not to have to work there, it's a blessing to have the job because the salary I make there not only entirely has paid off all my debts, it has also supported our family now and all the people that we live with and very much to do with our entire project except the actual building. I would trade it all to be full-time in our facility in West Virginia. I consider it an honor, and it's a great privilege to get the kind of inside picture into human suffering that working in a big city mental institution gives you. We see the patients before they're medicated, right when they come off the street. And so I feel I have a real pulse beat in these 6 years of the 4,000 or 5,000 people that I've seen there on the depths of human suffering. And it's one of the great motivations to carry on.
What do you think about the approach to care that these people get?
At St. Elizabeth's?
Mm-hmm.
It certainly isn't the ideal, which is a very polite statement. A person that's suffering in their mental or spiritual part of their being, to stick them in an institution with 1,500, 2,000 other people, with a very low staff, a place that looks kind of like a prison, that's very drab, that relies very heavily on pharmaceuticals, is not a place for growth to enrich a person's quality of their life. It is a place to control and help the society control these factions, and so it does that job fairly well. I have very little good feeling about the quality of the care there. Not necessarily that there are bad providers, it's just not my perception, largely based on my experience in my practice, for what people that are mentally ill need.
Is it personally difficult for you to resolve some of those, you know, the inconsistency between that treatment and what your own philosophy is?
Well, in the emergency room, we don't do a treatment. And in the room with the patient, I'm able to do the treatment with them that I would at home. I'm able to offer them the suggestions that I would at home, and I don't have to be a different doctor. I think that anyone that wanted to could consider it a compromise, and I would be the first to say that to do almost anything in life, you have to compromise, and I can only thank St. Elizabeth's for helping us out so much. And I haven't felt myself that I've had to compromise with the individual patients the moment I'm with them.
We were speaking earlier about malpractice insurance, and you don't carry malpractice insurance. Why was that a difficult decision to reach? Because that would put you at some professional risk, wouldn't it, that you don't carry it?
It's the least risk of all of our activities. We chose not to own anything. We chose to live very frugally and poorly. And not owning anything and not carrying malpractice insurance were of very little financial value to anyone. And my understanding of the malpractice system is that a lawyer is a lot more likely to take on a case where they can make $100,000, $200,000 than they are a case where there's no profit involved in winning the situation. I don't like this system of malpractice that makes the doctors feel like they're to blame for the mistakes that we make. We make mistakes. Every day we make mistakes. The latest issue of Harper's has a very nice article about a doctor who owns up to his mistakes. We make mistakes. We kill people. We make mistakes that destroy lives. We don't make a lot of them. Most doctors remember every one. Maybe in a way, every day we make little ones. How we cut off a patient, how we ignore an issue, those sort of things. I just will not be placed in a position of mistrust with a patient. I will not be placed in a position to where I think I have to know the answers. I don't know the answers. I would be the first to say that.
Do you have any understanding with your patients about your feelings on that? Are they aware of that? Is it implicitly understood?
Well, each patient is different. Some patients really like our whole shtick. They want to be friends with us the rest of our lives. They want medicine to be just one of our exchanges. That, of course, is our ideal. There are those who say, cut the crap, doc. I want my pill and get out of here. I don't want to know anything, you know. So what? Less and less do we get that kind, but I'd say for most of our 13 years, we had a lot more people that just wanted the quick fix than the whole shtick.
You also refuse third-party payments. Can you say why and what the implications of that are, what the underlying philosophy of that is?
Well, our whole approach in starting out the philosophical part of our practice was, what are the problems in healthcare? And how can we address them? The problems that we saw, we figured that the best way to address them was not to be involved in them. The problem with third-party insurance, and I think it's pretty well documented how it's driven up the cost of health care, how people say, it's been shown in studies that if you have insurance, the same procedure can cost you this many more hundreds of dollars than if you don't have insurance. Same procedure, everything's the same, but if you have insurance, we'll charge you $500 more. Because it's such an abused system, we didn't want to have anything to do with it. It's a big government thing, and big government doesn't seem to me to solve individual problems.
It seems, however, the underlying reasons for the system, which is, let's say, in the example of workman's compensation, health insurance, when somebody has an accident and doesn't have the money for medical care, but that there is a system that is at least intended to support their ability to get medical care. It seems like the principles of health insurance would be consistent with what the Gesundheit Institute does, which is to help ensure that everybody gets the medical care that they need.
It's a very... On paper, it's a very delightful system. The problems are, and you can look in the for-profit hospital situation, and that's where things are headed, and we have it in lesser forms in the nonprofit hospitals. But it's not the patients that have abused it. It is the healthcare providers, the hospitals and the physicians and everyone else that benefits from those systems. So, yes, in some cases, it's great for the patients, but still, it's such an abused system that we just didn't want to have anything to do with it.
The Gesundheit Institute seems very much based on 60s values. You make a point of refusing payment for services, of working in a kind of communally based interactive spirit. Has there been any change in your own philosophy, either as you've gotten older or as you live in the 1980s?
What has happened as I've gotten older? The whole thing has gotten a lot more reinforced. I feel a lot more understanding of the practice as opposed to the philosophy. When I started out, it was a philosophical thought. We've lived it now for 13 years, and it's totally shown to be the great joy that we had hoped it would be. So I've gotten more ardent in my desires and insisting that I practice this way. We refused publicity the first 12 years. We've thought it wrong to seek publicity, to put the doctors yet again in the public eye. But because we've been refused from foundations and the government and from traditional moneyed sources to build our facility, we felt we had to go to the people. And I guess also too many people had come forward encouraging us to inspire people, that they felt that an important part of our message to inspire. One of the things that was obvious in our early practice that we've had to change, because we've had nothing resembling a private life, the staff always live. We had 15 to 20 people living in a house that had as minimum of 5 to 10 guests a night and as many as 50. And this is in a regular, large, single-family dwelling. So in this new facility, we're definitely going to have a bedroom for each staff person so that they each have their little corner of private space. And that is a change. I think as far as the ideals, most of them have only gotten further and more deeply entrenched, particularly with the prolonged and intensive study of the social situation that we're living in right now.
Have you found yourself setting your own personal limits just to avoid burnout and to keep as much vitality in your own practice and life as possible?
I've not experienced my own limits to burnout. I experience other staff people's limits of burnout and have tried to, in the new facility we're building, I've been trying to address those things. The practice of medicine, if it's your way of life, if it is not separated from your life and you love it, that is the experience that you have of it. And I have that experience. Medicine, the practice of medicine every day is a great and wonderful joy. I like it so much, I'd do it for nothing.
What's your sense of the possibility of change on a larger level to bring medicine more in line with the principles that you're interested in?
I think medicine is just reflecting the principles that are fairly world-dominant, the greed, power that dominate the world's thinking, from the rich to the poor, the taking as much as you can, the serving yourself, self-serving, narcissistic kind of world that we live in, that has to change. That the way, what we're talking about in medicine is true in law, in car mechanics, in government, all the way down the line. We have greedy, power-hungry people in the positions of these places that are looking to get more greedy and more money. And I think the basic fabric of our society, if that is the fabric, must change.
What's the status of your work in reopening?
Well, we could open in 2 years. Our last year's publicity campaign drew us about $102,000. We need $1 million to build our facility. And so before 1982, the most ever donated was $3,000 in a year. So we feel really on the verge. The publicity and just going around and sharing the ideas with people. I have enough physicians now to fill 5 facilities, enough energy to build it. We have free labor. So I feel totally excited. We've broken ground, and that's a thrill.
It's been really interesting talking with you. Thanks for being here today on Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's been fun.